I'm going to talk to you about a study that I've been involved with for about the past few years, and this is just a subpart of the study, looking at screening and brief intervention among Medicaid beneficiaries with diabetes in Wisconsin. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Wisconsin's ESPRT program to lay the foundation for where this study stemmed from. So Wisconsin's ESPRT was a SAMHSA-funded grant between 2006 and 2011. The program involved 31 primary care clinics, one emergency department, and one trauma center. And like the first presentation, a unique aspect of this program is that it used paraprofessional health educators to administer the program. For the most part, they were bachelor-level health educators. Some of them were master's-level. But this really gets at one of the major implementation barriers of ESPRT, which is time, physician time, and also financial, the financial barrier, as they're less expensive than a clinician-administered program. Another aspect of the program that I want to highlight here is that this was a universal implementation. So the program didn't just target people that the health educators thought may have excessive substance use. It was a universal implementation, which I think is a key aspect of this, that any screening was considered treatment for the purpose of this study. The substance use screen was four questions. We used the NIAAA single screen, single alcohol screen, a two-item conjoint screen, and then also a general other drug use screen. If they were positive for the screen, they received a brief assessment, which included the World Health Organization Assist tool, as well as the three NIAAA quantity frequency questions. And for more information about Wisconsin's ESPRT program, take a look at the citation at the bottom by Dr. Brown in the American Journal of Managed Care. It's a great article giving a good overview of Wisconsin's ESPRT program, which is called the Wisconsin Initiative to Promote Healthy Lifestyles. You see the logo there in the bottom corner. The background on why I got interested in looking at screening and brief intervention among individuals with diabetes is, as we know, it's on the rise, not only in the United States, but globally. The rate of diagnosed and undiagnosed is somewhere between 12 and 14%. Pre-diabetes is around 38%. But more alarmingly for me is the fact that it's increasing in every age group, both sexes, every racial ethnic group, and by all education levels and all poverty income racial tertiles. This was a study published this year in JAMA. And that's really alarming. And so I wanted to specifically look at how screening and brief intervention may impact healthcare utilization in this particular group. We know that among individuals with diabetes, there's about $176 billion direct healthcare costs, 43% of which are due to inpatient care, which becomes more important when I take you through the results. On a per-patient level, we're looking at about $13,700, 58% attributed directly to diabetes care itself. Diabetics with alcohol drug problems have about double the annual per capita health care costs, so we do see a correlation there. And higher alcohol screening scores are associated with poor diabetes self-management behaviors. So you can start to see the mechanism through which screening and brief intervention becomes important for diabetes care management. For this particular study, we included working-age adults, 18 to 64 years old. They had to have Medicaid eligibility at least 1 month in each of the three time periods. We had three time periods, baseline, year one period, and then two follow-up periods, year one and year two. So those are the 3 1-year time periods where they had to have at least 1 month of Medicaid eligibility. They had to have visited a WIFL clinic between 2007 and 2010 and have a completed background and eligibility file in our data set. For the comparison group, we used a sex-based frequency match sample from within the same WIFL clinics of Medicaid patients that did not receive screening and brief intervention. Again, the idea that the implementation was universal, it was random, non-targeted, the thought that getting a comparison sample from within the clinic would reduce the variability that may come in on the clinic level in terms of the utilization that patients are facing and the different options they have with the clinicians. We did stratify by dual eligibility status, so we also received eligibility, Medicare eligibility, and other insurance eligibility files for all the participants in the study. So we could see if they had dual eligibility, and we did stratify by that status, which again becomes important when we look at the results. The reason for that is because the utilization patterns are quite different between the two groups. So a brief diagram of the study design itself. We did get a third comparison group, which we will be studying ongoing. But for the sake of this study, we're looking at the internal comparison group, which is that G1 on the bottom, and then the ESPER treatment group. This is the larger overall study from which we used to identify the diabetic patients, which I'm reporting on today. But there is a larger, more comprehensive study that is under review in a paper right now. So I'm going to be talking just about the internal comparison group. We use the difference in differences approach. So you see the two groups of ESPERT diabetic patients and non-ESPERT diabetic patients. We used the year before receiving ESPERT as the baseline compared to post-utilization in year one and year two of follow-up. So we have a 24-month follow-up period, which is unique compared to a lot of ESPERT studies, which look at just the first 12 months. And we do tend to see an attenuation effect after 12 months. So we thought it was important to take that extra year and look at the 24-month time period. So we compared the two differences in each group, and therefore we get the difference in differences model. For the outcome measure, we used a per member per month. So we were able to adjust by the number of months that each person was eligible for Medicaid, which becomes important because there is some churning within Medicaid as they become eligible, not eligible. But so we did take that into consideration. For the data, we used the WIFL ESPERT program data from 2007 to 2010, and we linked it to each individual's Medicaid claims. So it was not self-report utilization. We used actual Medicaid claims to determine their utilization patterns. And we used both fee-for-service and managed care encounter claims for all the individuals. We extracted the data between 2006 and 2011 for each and every patient that we received data on. We included denied claims because we were interested in utilization itself, not necessarily just utilization that was reimbursed by Medicaid. So we did include denied claims. And for the same reason that we were interested in utilization, we excluded dental, lab, pharmacy, and long-term stay claims because we were mainly interested in outpatient, inpatient, and emergency department use. The whole process involved data use agreements with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, the University of Wisconsin Department of Family Medicine, University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, which was a learning curve in and of itself. Just to navigate those waters was pretty enlightening for me. I'll take you a little bit through the demographics, and this is just a snapshot, but for the most part, the groups, both the non-dually eligible group and the dually eligible group, were comparable. We see by, you know, no differences in sex or age. We did see some differences in race with a higher number of black patients in the ESPERT group compared to the non-ESPERT group. We see the same thing in the dually eligible group as well. When we looked at baseline health conditions, we did not see any significant differences or baseline alcohol-related diagnosis or baseline mental health conditions. All that was pretty similar. So here are the utilization results. And so we took the per member per month and calculated per member per year, just to make it a little bit more interpretable for us in moving forward. And I broke it down by dual eligibility status. So the first column, you see non-dually eligible Medicaid patients, where we don't see much change at all in any of the outcomes, the outpatient days, inpatient admissions, and ER admissions. But among the dually eligible group, we do see significant reductions in inpatient days and inpatient admissions in both of those groups. And we also see an increase in outpatient days. It's not significant, but I think that whole change in pattern, if you take a step back and look at the big picture, is interesting. in seeing a shift occur from a decrease in inpatient to an increase in outpatient. And, you know, are those extra outpatient visits more preventive care? Is it that there's a greater awareness of complications that they weren't aware of before that now going through screening and brief intervention they become aware of? So we don't know that for sure, but it is an interesting result when you compare the different outcomes. And we did adjust for sex, age, race, prior mental health diagnosis, and prior alcohol-related diagnosis. Again, these were all extracted from the claims data using the appropriate ICD-9 codes. We took it a step further, and we wanted to look at fiscal results. What does this mean for dollars? That's what Medicaid wants to know, right? What does this mean for us in terms of cost savings? So we used the fee-for-service reimbursed claims to identify what does it cost for an outpatient day? What does it cost for an inpatient day for the Wisconsin Medicaid program? And we applied it to the changes we saw, the utilization changes that we saw. And again, in the dually eligible group, you know, we see a pretty significant decrease in overall costs and an overall cost savings of about $2,700 per patient per year. Now, this represents about an 8% reduction in healthcare costs among dually eligible diabetic patients. So, you know, it is pretty significant when you take that and extrapolate it to a statewide level, you know, talking millions of dollars of potential cost savings. And again, remember that this is a universal implementation. Okay, this just isn't among individuals that screened positive or that received a brief intervention or that had excessive drinking behavior. This is universal among individuals that were seen at the WIFL clinics, which I think is important. And that's what we really wanted to get at. What does a universal, scaled-up version of screening and brief intervention look like? Because I think we've seen sort of trials and we've seen intervention results, but if a state were to just implement this universally, what would it look like? And in a cost-efficient way, using health educators. I appreciated the first presentation, too, that's trying to look at taking this next step of adapting ESPR to a non-clinician format, which I think is going to be really important to take it forward. Some of the strengths and limitations of our study. The strength, it's a population-based study among non-treatment-seeking low-income adults, which is one of the first population-based studies really looking at screening and brief intervention. It's a large sample size, which allowed us to dig deeper into this subpopulation of patients with diabetes. And it was a non-physician-led, real-world implementation of screening and brief intervention with all the nuances that come from a real-world implementation. Limitations is that clinics self-selected themselves into WIFL. So, you know, they may have known already that they have a high amount of individuals with excessive substance use. We don't know, but they did self-select to participate in the WIFL program. And as you saw in some of the demographics, there is some evidence that we may have a selectivity bias going on in terms of who is being targeted for screening and brief intervention in those clinics. Again, because the initial implementation was to be universal, that's how we went forward with the analysis. And we do not have any utilization that took place outside of Medicaid, again, because we all we received were the Medicaid utilization. Even though we knew if they were eligible for Medicare or other insurance, we didn't have access to any of those claims. This is just a Medicaid utilization study. And we had limited data on intervention intensity, mainly because the way the tablets that the health educators were using, if a patient received a second brief intervention, it overrode the first one. So all we have data for is the last brief intervention that they received, unfortunately, which would have been a great question to take, you know, to the next step is, did intervention intensity matter? Some of the conclusions and implications. Paraprofessional administered ESPR does lead to changes in high-cost utilization among dually eligible diabetes patients. Again, not so much in the non-dually eligible, but again, in this high-cost patient group, we do see changes. And incorporating ESPR into diabetes care and treatment plans could be a low-cost behavior change strategy. And I think this is something that hopefully this study will bring to our attention. And that Medicaid programs could benefit beneficiaries if they reimburse for paraprofessional administered ESPR services. This is something that is not universal in Medicaid programs. In Wisconsin, health educators health educator administered SBIRT is reimbursed, but that's not the same for all states. And so hopefully this study will kind of bring that awareness out there that Medicaid could benefit in terms of costs as well as health outcomes for Medicaid patients if they reimburse for paraprofessional administered SBIRT. Future research and where we want to go with this, we're going to investigate the association and take this to the next step by looking at the external comparison group, and that'll give us a little bit better idea of the selectivity bias that may be occurring within the internal comparison group. We want to study the impact of SBIRT integrated with diabetes peer support teams. So with my organization, Kingdom Workers, we support diabetes peer support teams here in the U.S. And so what would that look like? You know, similar from, the first presenter looking at the Promotores program, implementing screening and brief intervention within community-based peer support programs. I think that could be a real neat component for us to really work with individuals with diabetes in their daily life. And how do you just manage life with this, which includes substance use? We also are interested in looking at the long-term impacts of diabetes-related complications as outcomes, using this rich data set that we have now with the program data linked to the utilization data. We can look at some of these long-term outcomes. And looking at other chronic diseases and specific utilization outcomes in terms of substance use related ER admissions, 30-day hospital readmissions, et cetera, that, again, is of interest to Medicaid as well as other insurers that are looking at some of these costly utilization outcomes. Acknowledgements, my research team, John Leahy, Paul Moberg, Richard Brown, Margaret Burns, Ajay Sethi, Dave Weimer, and Daphne Kuhl helped with the overall study as well as this specific study on patients with diabetes, the SAMHSA 5-year grant to support WIFL, the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and the University of Wisconsin Department of Family Medicine for helping with the data extraction process. So if you have questions, my email is there, and then the organization I work with is also there. So thank you.
Thank you.